Thank you. Christian Kim on behalf of the appellants, Junho Yang and Ho Sun Yang. At the outset, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, the central question in this appeal is whether or not a blanket admission of facts to an underlying state court complaint, which includes both fraud and non-fraud causes of action, by itself is sufficient for the application of collateral estoppel when a state court judgment excludes any express factual findings of fraud. The appellants submit that the answer to that is no. But before I get to the law behind why our position is no, I want to go over some of what happened in the first appeal. Now, as the court is aware, there's two bankruptcy courts at issue here. The first bankruptcy court ruled on three separate motions for summary judgment. The first motion for summary judgment was denied based on collateral estoppel grounds. Now, the appellees won't dispute that. The second motion for summary judgment was based on the stipulated facts, which was denied for technical reasons. And then the third motion for summary judgment was the one that was granted, also based on the fact that the appellant Junho Yang has stipulated to the underlying facts in the state court complaint. Now, the first bankruptcy judge in this case, in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, did not include any findings of fact that the appellant that there was any collateral estoppel issues, that were decided upon, including whether or not the case was actually litigated or necessarily decided. It was based upon the factual allegations in the complaint, which stated that there were sufficient allegations to support a claim for 523A2A. Now, this summary judgment decision was appealed to the BAP, and neither party argued collateral estoppel at that level. And then it wasn't until the case went to the Ninth Circuit that this court found that collateral estoppel is the only way that you could have this judgment apply in a subsequent proceeding. And it wasn't until after that time on remand that the appellees argued that, in fact, Judge Nider, the first bankruptcy judge, must have decided the issues on collateral estoppel, and therefore the only issue that needed to be decided was the issue of intent. Now, Your Honors, I submit that that conclusion is incorrect based on the Ninth Circuit precedents that have been cited in the appellant's briefs. Now, I'll specifically point to the case of In re Harmon, as well as the Bank of China versus Huang case and the Waldersee case. So in the Harmon case, the Ninth Circuit found that although all the requirements of a 523A2A claim were present, sufficiently alleged in the underlying state court complaint, the court still had to make the determination that the threshold requirements to satisfy collateral estoppel were met, specifically the actually litigated and necessarily decided prongs. Now, because the complaint in that case included both fraud and non-fraud causes of action and did not, in the corresponding judgment, did not include any express factual findings of fraud, the court would not apply collateral estoppel. And that was the same situation that occurred in the Bank of China case as well as the Waldersee case. Similarly, in those cases, the underlying state court complaint included multiple causes of action. Under California law, you have to be able to determine that, in fact, the issue of fraud was necessarily decided in order for collateral estoppel to apply. And if that requirement is not met, then collateral estoppel is improper.
Counsel, I want to interject.
Yes, Your Honor.
A question to clarify my understanding. Why wouldn't it be true that even if an issue is resolved by a stipulation in a litigated case, that stipulation is actually decided?
Well, because Your Honor, like in the case in Levinson, which is a case that's relied upon appellees, there was a stipulation, but the consent judgment in that case included express findings that there was defalcation that occurred. Now, unless there's express findings, a subsequent court can't know for sure whether or not the issue of fraud or the issue of breach of contract was in fact necessarily decided and actually litigated. That's why I submit, Your Honor, in under California law, there is that express finding requirement.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Isn't the language in the stipulated judgment pretty broad? I mean, it doesn't use the word fraud specifically, but it says stipulates to the facts supporting the claims made against him, and there were fraud claims in the complaint. So, you know, can't we infer that there was a stipulated judgment and finding of fraud here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the judgment itself doesn't refer to any facts. Perhaps the stipulation does, but the judgment itself only assesses a specific damages amount of, I believe it's $3.6 million or so. And you know, the appellants submit that that specific damages amount could have just as easily have been based on the breach of contract cause of action as opposed to the fraud cause of action. So as the standard is set forth in the California Supreme Court case of Lucido versus Superior Court, Your Honor, I think it was the issue of fraud was entirely unnecessary to the court's imposition of damages in that judgment. The state court could have easily assessed the damages of $3.6 million or whatever it was exactly based on solely the breach of contract cause of action.
The part, counsel, in the settlement agreement, as I'm reading it correctly, is the facts supporting your client explicitly admitted to, quote, the facts supporting the claims made against him, and that said facts are within the phrasing of Section 523. Well, and there's a whole question about, there's legal questions about not being able to pre-decide issues for a bankruptcy. But just the fact that he would say, I'm explicitly admitting to these facts, and I think these facts are consistent with a statute that is about fraud, seems to me like it's all but saying that he's admitting to fraud.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, at the outset, I would submit that that paragraph is a invalid pre-petition waiver of the bankruptcy discharge.
Right. That's, putting that aside, okay, so that's sort of a separate legal issue. If we're just talking about, you know, going all the way back to Judge Gould's question and Judge Lee's follow-up question that, you know, what about if he, why isn't it enough that he admitted to, you know, the party stipulated essentially to fraud? He says that he agrees to these facts. If you read the facts, they actually that were in the complaint. They definitely, all of the facts, if you accepted all of them, there's definitely lots of fraud there. And then he goes on to say that those facts are within the phrasing of a statute that's about fraud. So putting aside the pre-petition waiver, and if you're just looking at this as has he admitted to fraud, has he stipulated to fraud, it's hard for me not to see how that isn't a stipulation to fraud.
Well, Your Honor, there's a lot of facts that are stipulated to in the complaint. As I pointed out, there's multiple different causes of action that don't relate to fraud. So the determination is, what did the judge decide in the state court? Was it necessarily decided that it was that the state court judge necessarily decided the fraud issue? I don't think that you can say that unless there's actual express factual findings of fraud in the judgment itself, which there is not in this case.
I think, so just to make sure I understand, your position is the parties can agree that there was fraud. What they can submit to the judge could include that agreement that there was fraud along with other things. But if what they submit to the judge and the judge signs doesn't itself include the findings of fraud, then your position would be, I mean, that the judge may have decided, he or she may have been willing to sign this based on agreement with the contract breach allegations as opposed to the fraud. Is that's I think that's what your whole argument maybe turns on.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that paragraph 12 doesn't necessarily mean that the defendant was admitting to fraud per se. It's admitting to all the facts in the complaint in order to settle the case. But I wouldn't necessarily say that it's that that stipulation of facts to all the facts in the complaint equates to an admission of fraud that can be used in collateral estoppel under California law.
I guess to pin down, I understand that not every fact that he may have admitted to would be a fact that would support fraud, but certainly some of the facts that he admitted to would support fraud. And he goes further and says, I admit that that these facts would fall within a statute that is about fraud. And so I guess that's what I'm saying. I think it all, so that part, hard for me to see how your client gets away from that. So it seems to me ultimately your argument kind of turns on, yeah, but notwithstanding that, unless the judge actually, what the judge signed, had an explicit sort of finding of fraud, then that's not good. Then that's what you have to have. I think that's what the agreement comes to.
I see that my time is up, Your Honor. If I can, let me just respond quickly. So, Your Honor, I believe that even if the complaint has sufficient allegations to show fraud, there still has to the threshold requirements of collateral estoppel still have to be met. And I don't believe, and the appellees have not cited any case in California or the Ninth Circuit that would support the position that the admission in and of itself is sufficient absent express findings of fraud in the judgment itself. With that, I reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll proceed to Mr. Edwards. Admit, Mr. Kim, for your planning purposes, we'll add an extra minute to your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mark Edwards appearing for Appellee Fund Management International. Initially, I think I would be remiss if I didn't point out to the court that this matter is now 20 years old, having been commenced with the state court action in 2001 and having now been up and down appellate court. And appellate court process twice. I'd like to address perhaps, I think the central issue, which is on appeal here, which is the sufficiency of the stipulation of facts. And I think that based upon discussion had with my colleague in his opening remarks, that and the comments of this court, this appears to be the central issue. And really what it boils down to is whether or not a stipulation of all facts that support all the claims in a complaint should be deemed sufficient. And another way of putting that is, does the fact that the parties voluntarily stipulated to all facts supporting all claims in the state court complaint, is that any less effective than if the parties had decided to comb through a multi-page complaint that has, I think, in excess of 180 paragraphs and hundreds of factual allegations, and had it gone to the trouble of actually determining or attempting to determine what it was that the parties did or didn't want to stipulate to. Now, suffice to say, if the appellants did not want to stipulate to certain facts in the state court complaint, they certainly didn't have to. They could have elected to negotiate the settlement and the stipulation for entry of judgment such that only those facts which they were willing to stipulate to were included in those documents. And then that way, if they truly intended not to stipulate to facts that would support a basis for for fraud and for non-dischargeability under 523, they could have proceeded in that fashion, but they didn't. And we're not here to rewrite what the parties who were represented by counsel and who had negotiated, who had litigated this case for several years before deciding to settle the case, you know, what they intended. And so I would submit, and as I think Judge Gould and Judge Lee pointed out, the fact that there is a stipulation to all facts supporting all the claims in the state court complaint, doesn't make the stipulation of facts defective, and doesn't negate the fact that among the facts stipulated to are clearly, and I don't think there's any dispute here, that there are clearly facts that support findings of fraud, and in fact, those facts were identified by FMI in its motion for summary judgment, and those facts are clearly identified in the bankruptcy court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. So there is no misunderstanding here as to what facts were being relied upon by the bankruptcy court when it went back and reviewed the stipulated facts. I would also point out, and I believe one of the justices mentioned this earlier, that it wasn't just that the Yangs stipulated to all of the facts supporting the claims in the state court complaint, but paragraph 12 of the settlement agreement goes further. It says that they're doing so, and they're admitting that the facts create liability and are within the meaning of Section 523. And so if there's any dispute over what they intended, and that there was a stipulation to facts that would support fraud claims, then the document itself makes it clear that in fact that's what they did, that there was a stipulation of facts, and among those facts there was a stipulation that there was liability under Section 523. And with respect to the issue raised as to whether or not the judgment itself needs to specify the specific findings upon which it's based, I would submit that it does not. The appellant failed to cite any case authority that supports such a holding. I'm not aware of any case that supports such a holding. And the cases that are briefed extensively in both appellant and appellee's briefs indicate that it is possible to have the application of collateral estoppel in connection with a stipulated judgment, and a stipulated judgment is entered based upon a stipulation of the parties. And in this case, there was a stipulation for entry of judgment, which provided for judgment to be entered based upon all the facts that were stated in the state court complaint, and that judgment would be entered based thereon. And so when the court in 2008, the state court, entered the judgment, it did so based upon the stipulation for entry of judgment. And so as a result, the judgment is based upon the stipulation of judgment, which in turn is based upon the stipulated facts that are contained in both the stipulation for entry of judgment and the settlement agreement.
If I can ask you one question here, and one thing that was a little bit odd in looking at our prior mendicity on this case as well as the bankruptcy court's decisions is when they talk about collateral estoppel, you know, the odd thing is they really don't discuss the traditional, you know, elements of collateral estoppel, decided or actually litigated. And that seems a little bit odd to me. I mean, why is that? Is that because we're assuming that those are easily met because of the stipulated judgment? I mean, it just seemed odd to me that they never discussed those elements in reading those opinions.
Well, Your Honor, I think Judge Russell, who was presiding over the bankruptcy proceeding following the remand, and of course this is a little bit unusual because I guess in large part because the case has gone on as long as it has, that we actually ended up with two bankruptcy court judges in connection with this matter. But I believe that Judge Russell, in part, believed that his review of this court's mandate indicated that the court, the Ninth Circuit, had reviewed the record in this matter in connection with the first appeal and had done so in the context of the application of collateral stop, whether or not it should or shouldn't be applied, and that it had indicated whether expressly or impliedly that what was missing for application of collateral stop was the issue of whether or not Mr. Yang intended to be bound by the admission of facts in a subsequent proceeding, and therefore remanded on that basis. And I believe, and if the court reviews the transcript from the hearing, bifurcated trial that occurred in front of Judge Russell very candidly acknowledges that that's what he understands the mandate is, and that he believes that this court has already reviewed the record and determined that there is one issue of collateral estoppel that needs to be addressed. And so he limits the hearing and his specific findings in that regard, although he does adopt Judge Nider's prior findings of fact and conclusions of law. And in fact, I would submit, Your Honor, that there are portions of the findings of fact and conclusions of law that would indicate that Judge Nider did in fact make findings that would support the elements of actually litigated and necessarily decided. But to answer your question, I think that's what Judge Russell had in mind. Now, I would add, Your Honor, that appellant raised this issue in front of Judge Russell and took the position, and I should be clear that my colleague, I think, misstated the fact. Appellee didn't take the position that the hearing that it necessarily needed to be limited. It certainly wasn't for us to make that determination. That was the bankruptcy court's decision. Judge Russell made it eminently clear from the minute we returned to his court that he believed that this court's mandate limited what it is that he was to consider at the evidentiary hearing. However, he did allow appellant to raise whatever additional issues vis-a-vis collateral estoppel that it thought should be considered by the court, because he had indicated that's how he intended to proceed, but he said, go ahead, submit a trial brief, and if you want to raise other issues, raise them. Now, I would point out to this court that appellant did not raise those elements in its trial brief. It did not contest the issues of actually litigated or necessarily decided with respect to the application of collateral estoppel. It only raised the issue of whether or not the findings were specific enough. In other words, that issue that I think we spent most of our time on today, which is whether or not a stipulation of all facts is sufficient to support a finding of fraud in this case. And if I could, as my time...
If I may switch to another topic, I've got a question on, and it relates to Mrs. Yang, the wife. I understand your arguments about privity, they're married, but it's clear from the record that the parties wanted to exclude her. She's not in the settlement agreement. I think, you know, it's clear she wasn't intended to be included here. I mean, what else could the parties have done more here to exclude her? I mean, is it just that sheer virtue of privity, there's no way to exclude her?
Well, let's be clear, Your Honor. The record indicates that Mrs. Yang was not excluded from the settlement agreement. She's a part of the settlement agreement. The term Yang is defined in the first paragraph of the settlement agreement includes Mrs. Yang. And so one would argue that the use of Yang in the settlement agreement includes Mrs. Yang. Also, paragraph 3 of the settlement agreement contains a series of essentially restrictive covenants that Mrs. Yang was bound by. In other words, there were provisions to ensure that the Yangs did not set up new companies and not use funds derived from those new companies to satisfy the settlement amount. And so, therefore, she had affirmative obligations under paragraph 3 to the extent new companies were created. In fact, that happened, and that's the subject of a separate lawsuit, not the subject of this appeal. But it clearly indicates that Mrs. Yang had those obligations. What really is the only real issue here is the fact that Mrs. Yang, and there is no dispute, that Mrs. Yang was not made a party to the stipulation for entry of judgment. But that's one thing, and to say that Mrs. Yang wasn't part of the settlement is another, and I think that's the whole point of the privity argument, Your Honor, is that she's bound by that judgment, notwithstanding the fact that she's not a party to it, based upon the principle of privity. And I would also add that, again, Mrs. Yang's, there were allegations against Mrs. Yang in the complaint, now albeit less than there were against Mr. Yang, but there are allegations of the complaint with respect to Mrs. Yang concerning a fraud. And in every phase of this litigation, including all of the intermediate appellate reviews, both the BAP in the first instance and the district court in this instance, both of those courts recognized that Mrs. Yang was the subject of fraud allegations and therefore the subject of some stipulated facts in the underlying documents.
What do we do with the testimony from FMI's executive or principal saying that the parties intended to exclude her from the agreement?
No, they intended to exclude her from the judgment. That's the testimony. Not that they intended to exclude her. Mr. Walker indicated that Mrs. Yang, that they had agreed, FMI had agreed that Mrs. Yang would not be a party to the stipulation for entry of judgment. And so there's no dispute about that, but that doesn't mean that she wasn't a party to the settlement and that she didn't stipulate the facts and that she didn't have affirmative obligations under paragraph 3. And so I'd submit that the arguments that prior courts in this case have relied upon and that we also have stated in our briefs would support her inclusion on the complaint for non-dischargeability. I think the court was kind enough to give me an additional minute. I'm happy to address any questions that the court may have since this is my one opportunity to speak.
Let me follow up on Judge Lee's question. If you don't, I think if I'm following your argument correctly, you know, you keep referring back to the fact that she was, and you did in your briefs, she's party to the settlement, and but I'm not sure, is that actually, does that make a difference to your legal argument that, you know, your legal argument is that she's bound because of privity, right? That's what your legal argument turns out. Your legal argument of her being bound, of her being subject to collateral estoppel, turn on the fact of whether or not she was a party to the settlement agreement? Because I'm not sure it does.
I think they both support it. I think they're independent basis for supporting.
Okay, so if that's right, then you're saying if we could pretend for a second that she had not been bound, that she had not entered into the settlement agreement, I still think you would be arguing based on your legal argument, or your legal argument would still support the idea that she would be subject, that she would be roped in under collateral estoppel. I think that's right.
Yes, that's correct.
I think ultimately Judge Lee's concern is sort of a valid one, which is there is nothing she could have done. Like, I mean, you say, well, you mentioned these other things that were involved, but none of those really matter ultimately. At the end of the day, because of privity, your argument is she would have got roped in regardless of any of these other, regardless of whether she'd done any of these other things.
Well, I think it's an independent argument. I do believe that alone would support it. But I think separate from the privity argument, the fact that she was also a debtor in the bankruptcy proceeding. And, Your Honor, she is named as a defendant in FMI's complaint for non-dischargeability. At no time did you...
I see your point, counsel. I think, at least the way I took it, Judge Lee was expressing concern. Like, so there's no way... The way your privity argument means there's no way you could actually exclude somebody, even if you wanted to. And I think that's true. I think your privity argument means there's no way she could have been excluded. She could have done whatever she wanted, and she still would have got roped in under your argument, right?
Well, it's my argument, and we rely on the Reynolds decision in that regard. But I would add that I think independently that's true, Your Honor, and I think In connection with the specific facts of this case, for all the reasons I just previously stated, what her involvement was relative to the allegations of state court complaint, her being a party to the settlement agreement, her being a debtor in the bankruptcy and her being a defendant in the complaint for non-dischargeability. When you consider all those facts, I think if there's any doubt in this case, there's no question that that's the case. My time appears to be up, and the only thing I'd ask this court is and if and to the extent there's any issue that this court sees in connection with whether or not paragraph 12 constitutes a pre-petition waiver, which we maintain it that it's not, and also the fact that even if it did, the Cole case and Levinson case make it clear that the court can still look to the stipulated facts in determining the issue of collateral estoppel. If there are any questions in that regard, I'd be happy to address them.
I have no questions. Judge Lee. Counsel, I think you're free of questions. And we're going to let Mr. Kim have rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I want to respond to my colleague's comment about us, the appellants, not citing any cases that would support a denial of collateral estoppel in pre-stipulated judgments. We did, in fact, cite two cases, which are directly on point. The Waldersick case, as well as the Bank of China versus Fong case. Both cases involved stipulated judgments. And both cases involved both fraud and non-fraud causes of action. But the courts, Ninth Circuit, in the Fong case, found that collateral estoppel should not apply because there was no express findings of fact. That's equally true in the district court case in the Waldersack situation, where the party stipulated to a judgment in that case as well. But the fact that there was no findings of fact was fatal for collateral estoppel purposes. In addition, my colleague talks about the bankruptcy court reliance on Cole and Levinson as the basis for being able to rely solely on the stipulated facts. As the court is aware, the statement in Cole is dicta, it's not precedential authority. And it essentially just cites the Klingman versus Levinson case, which is a Seventh Circuit case. And that case is clearly distinguishable here because, as I alluded to earlier, the consent judgment in that case included express factual findings of defalcation. So I believe that those issues, those cases are not determinative whatsoever in this particular appeal. Now, with respect to Mrs. Yang, Your Honors, we don't deny that she would have community responsibility if there was a non-dischargeability judgment against the husband based on privity. But I think the point is that she was not included in the judgment. She was not included in the stipulation for entry judgment. And now to use collateral estoppel to have her collateral estoppel from disputing a judgment where she's not even the named judgment debtor is improper because ultimately, even if she has community responsibility, if she has a non-dischargeability judgment against her now, that impacts not only the community estate, but also her separate property. So that's really the issue here when it comes to Mrs. Yang. And with that, Your Honors, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
None here. Judge Leake. I think we don't have any questions. And I want to say I admire the perseverance of counsel in vigorously representing their clients for a couple of decades. We'll try to make a ruling before another 20 years passes. The Yang case shall now be submitted with our thanks to the advocates. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.